Date August 11th, 1983. His address is now the Holyoke Towers. He mentioned during the interview he is 84 years old. Interviewee, Barbara Higgins Aubrey, historian at the Armory.
You went to work at the Armory in 1935, according to the questionnaire you sent back.
That's right.
Yeah. How did you happen to go to work at the Armory? Were you from Springfield then? Or?
No, I'm a native of Canada, and it was during a depression, and I was laid out for a while, and I had a brother in Boston who was district manager of the William Steel Company, and he was up one day, and he saw this civil service, you know, just someone wanted at the Armory as a temporary. That's about the lowest designation in my department. And at that time, I was up home in Canada. And he sent me a wire up there that I had a chance to go to work. So I came back as quickly as I could and arrived here. And I think it was on a Sunday. And I filled out the application and
at the Armory?
At the Armory.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to undergo a physical examination.
Did they provide that too?
They did.
Mm-hmm. A doctor right there?
No. There was probably a doctor at the Armory, but I asked if I could have another doctor. I came to Boston after in Canada. And they sent me to a doctor back there. And,
in Boston?
Yeah. If I recall right, and, he was asking the circumstances, and I told him I was without a work for a long time.
Depression, yes.
Yeah. And he says, there's a physical exam here. You've got to lift something about 150 pounds over your head.
150 pounds?
Something like that, you know. I said, not me. Oh, he says, you'll get out of work for so long, I'll take a chance on you. And that's how I passed.
That was pretty good.
That was pretty good, yeah. And when I landed up in Springfield, I went to the court place and place over on Union Street, which is parallel to State Street.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I always remember the landlady's name was the same as mine, the last name, Neil, Mrs. Neil. I think she could be a grandmother of the Neil, Richard Neil, that's running for Union Street.
Remember what you say, it's being recorded. Although he gets to say whether we could use it or not.
So that's how I started.
How old were you then?
36.
You were 36 at the time?
Yeah.
Were you married then?
No.
No, we got married later.
The funny part, when we first got married, our first place where we the place was in the apartment, right across there.
Oh my goodness.
What a coincidence.
I've been there 4 years now. When my second baby was expected, then we moved over to Mountain Street in your father's house. You know, but it seems strange for him to be living across from where we started out.
That's wonderful.
Funny thing, I started at the lowest pay, I think it was about $2.60 a day. But I had some experience in heat treating metallurgical.
You've had experience in Canada?
Yeah, in metallurgy. I'm a graduate of MIT. And I had a job at Waltham Watch, where they used to get the old Waltham Watch system.
Mm-hmm.
I went to work there for one of the youngest. And I floated around and went out west to get more experience in the steel business, working steel.
Where did you work out west?
Oh, I went out in Ohio and
Ohio.
Famous Steuben Hill, if you heard the name.
Oh, yes, yes.
Where was it? Dana, well, it used to be Barton. Notorious burglary. Martins. Dean Martins. Birthplace.
Steuben Hill, yeah, that's right.
And in the, I worked in West Virginia, too. Worked in Worcester. Charged the heat treated them, it's not charged the heat treated them, worked in the heat treated them, but I can see them when I can do that. So I had some experience that I was willing to take the lower grade job to get, just get in. They said, once you get your foot in.
Once you get your foot in, you're mm-hmm. better off. Right? This is my little friend that takes the notes for me. If you ever saw my writing, you'd know why we use a recorder.
That doesn't look bad.
Well, that's rather nice, yes. Besides, it's oral history, so it sounds better when it's your voice. So. But you say you were in Canada when you heard about the job at the Springfield Armory.
That's right. When my application was accepted.
Did your family live in Canada? Was that why you were up there?
I was born up there. My father and mother were living up there.
Mm-hmm.
There's five boys in the family, and they all...
Were you the younger, or...?
No, I'm the second youngest and the only surviving of five.
Oh, my goodness. That's a nice family. You said you were a graduate of MIT.
That's right.
Do they have majors? I mean, you had specialized in the field while you were at MIT. I know they're technical and all that. But
yeah, metallurgy.
Metallurgy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you came to the armory, did you live in Springfield when you began to work there?
Yes, up until the time we got married. I lived there about 3 or 4 months. No, I came in May and we got married in November.
Well, I had met him. I worked in Worcester for the telephone company. I worked in Hoyo for the telephone company. Some of us were sent down there
to
teach the supervisors how to work the dial system. That was the beginning of the dial system.
Sent down to the armory, you mean?
Worcester.
Oh, to Worcester.
Okay. Worcester, yeah. So that's where I met him, in Worcester. And after he came up here, he got the job. I went with him quite a while, but he wasn't working, you know, during the hard times. And I wasn't going to give up my job at the telephone company. I worked there 13 years before he was here. So then we got married. He's yeah. Nova Scotia, you know, not Canada's such a big place, but he's from Nova Scotia. I shouldn't be talking.
Oh, we'd like to have all the stories. Well, that's fine.
People wonder how we met. It was quite a coincidence, you know. And there were three other girls in the roaming place at Worcester, wasn't it?
Telephone.
They used to send girls down for training, for diet training.
To train their people, because we knew it before we went down, was to train their supervisors. We had to relieve them, you know.
So how did you meet? How did you meet? If there were three other girls, you met this particular one. How did you do that?
There was too many other girls around, so I wasn't paying any attention. I didn't know which one to play, I guess.
Did you meet at a party or through friends, or
well,
how?
She used to come over to visit her, the friends.
There were some telephone girls living in the house he was living in. I was living in a different house with other supervisors. And we used to go back and forth because they were from Springfield, you know. I didn't know any of them personally, but we used to go back and forth to visit. So one evening, a couple of us went over and the woman had the home where she lived. So I said, "Carol, I'm going to meet you." So I went in. She introduced us and then we started going out together.
That's where I met my doom.
Oh, your poor doom.
You seem to have done pretty well by it.
Yeah.
I'm not complaining, please.
You started as a laborer then at the Army.
I started as a laborer, yeah. What used to get my goats used to get so much more money than I did, but
worked yourself up. You started at the bottom.
That's right.
You couldn't do any differently.
When you started, which building did you work in? Do you remember?
Yes, I worked in the heat treating in the Hill.
And which building was that in?
Oh, 103.
103?
Yeah.
Did you work on the first floor, second floor? Do you remember?
There was only one floor.
There was only one floor,
yeah.
In 103. Okay. Was this in the big room? As it was, you see they've redone so much of it.
Yeah. Oh, no, it wasn't too much.
How many other men were in there?
Oh,
when
in
you
that
started.
Apartment, there was probably around 20. That is in the, that the heat treating came under the laboratory then. Mr. Oliver was the supervisor. And I was there about a month or so. And they sent me down to the other plant, the water shops. And I was there quite a while, learning something about the thing, you know. It was a different ball game for me, dealing with small parts into big parts, you know, watch parts, you know, when
mm-hmm.
I said, well, damn, what's happening?
The gun parts get to be a little bigger.
Yes. And I got along pretty well there. One of the officers kept talking to me one day, and he started asking me about my experience, and I told him what experience I had. And he says, what are you doing here? I said, well, that's a job. I want to start here. He says, I'll see you about it sometime. Oh, another month's time. I was called to the superintendent's office down there to report up to the Hill. I said, what do I do now? What's wrong? I was wondering what the deal was going on. And I met the officer in charge there. He says, we want you to work over the heat treating now, to take charge of the heat treating.
Take charge of it, huh?
Take charge of it, yeah. And Oliver, the metallurgist, was in charge, but I think he was glad to see me go there. And first thing he told me, he said, well, we got a problem here. Some certain parts we got to harden. I don't know whether you know anything about heat treating or not, but I guess they were having quite a lot of trouble with them. After they'd heat treat them, they'd notice that they were heat treating, a lot of them were cracked. And he says, well, that's your problem. He was glad to wash his hands off.
Were these barrels or small parts?
Parts of the gun.
Parts of them, okay.
Parts of the gun for the Navy. And I studied it for a while. I won't say I came on it right out the bat. And I'll start looking at them one day and start moving around, hitting them. Then I thought of the old trick we used to see down home when the locomotive would stop. The driver had a hammer and hit it and listen. So I tried that. I tried them.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell difference in sound of different pieces.
Uh-huh.
And that way, I was able to pick up the cracked ones.
You're sure you didn't crack
them? No, that was what, no. Those were previously heated at the water shops, so.
These were the parts you were checking?
Yeah.
Found they'd been,
mm-hmm.
they were
Well, that's just a small thing. One of the reasons, I don't know whether I got any break on account of that, but I relieved Oliver of a lot of trouble. He was glad, you know, to bother with the heat treating anymore.
Did you make recommendations for anything they could do to get around this, or?
Oh, yes, yeah. They got around it. And then gradually a heat treater, and that made me gang boss, and then assistant foreman, and then foreman.
Now, what was the difference in the jobs? Can you tell me a little about it? When you became gang boss, what were your duties then?
Oh, it was site supervision over the laborers to see that they were doing their job right, and putting the work in the furnace, and using the right temperatures and stuff like that. And the next step was something a little higher, keener supervision.
You said gang boss, then assistant supervisor, am I right? Was that the next thing?
Gang boss and assistant foreman.
Assistant foreman, okay. And as an assistant foreman, how did your duties differ from being a gang boss?
Well, you'd relay the foreman, you'd take a lot of his responsibility and what he'd be out and so on, things like that.
And what would be the duties of a foreman? Can you describe them to me?
Well, he had the charge of the personnel, seeing how many they wanted, and the different qualifications, different jobs, different wages of job, place the right people in the right position.
You had to rate them, didn't you? Didn't you have to mark them for their work?
As a foreman?
Oh, sure. The foreman marked them all the time.
Did they have formal worksheets, forms that you did this on?
Yes, yeah. Yes, when you had to come to rate them, you had to have these job efficiencies, of course.
How often did you fill those out? Once a month? Once every...
Oh, about every 2 months.
About every 2 months. And did you talk to the men about how you rated them, or did you...
Oh, yes, yeah. And, of course, you reach a lot of disagreements. This fellow's getting smarter than I am, and I'm doing just as much. And those problems, and they weren't half as bad on until I started getting the women in.
Until they started getting the women in. When did that happen?
Women into work, yeah.
Well, at that time, that's what they increased production very much. The women, you'd have two or three wives working together. One would say, "Oh, it's too cold. Close the windows," and the other one would say, "It's okay for me."
You know who said that? It was peaceful until the
woman
came.
Yeah. They worked regular work like the men did?
Kind of work, yeah.
They had the same duties?
They had this. Their work was easier. They didn't have to do any lifting, any hard lifting, anything like that.
Did they wear special clothing? Did they wear coveralls or anything?
No, they had to. They're supposed to wear hairnets.
Mm-hmm. Were they working at long benches, stations, workstations, or?
Yeah, some of them working on benches, and some of them feeding the work into a furnace with a continuous belt. They were just putting the parts on one end and taking them out at the other. So they were finished.
Did you have any women before World War II, or was that when they came?
No, before World War II.
Were any of the men who worked with you exempt because of the what kind of work they were doing? Were they protected from the draft in World War II? Do you remember any of that?
Oh, yes, yeah. There was some of them that we had deferred, you know.
Deferred?
Yeah. You try and protect your best workers, naturally. You try to keep them and write in a good report on them.
You needed them for the production.
We needed them for production, that's right.
You say you had two women. Do you remember who they were?
You had more than two. Mm-hmm.
More than two. Mm-hmm. 22.
22.
Just 22.
How many people did you have working for you in all at that time?
Well, at the... I think they had about but then 120th the hill. But that was after they put up a new building there.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have at least. We started in a small, room, and when I first came out, I think there was, in the heat treating, I said there was 9 or 10, that was at the metal finish. In the heat treating there was about 5 or 6 plus there. I always recall, you know, I think I had a sense of humor. When I first started the folks, sometimes they took some of their homework in, you know. One day I went in, I was making the rounds and I saw a fellow hammering away. He was fixing his shoes.
Fixing his shoes?
Yeah. Putting the heels on or something. And I went around a little later. I said, oh, that's the same fellow. See, there's something different about him. So he's using his left hand. So I said to him, Worcester, I didn't know you were ambidextrous. Man, didn't you know I'm a Yorkshire man?
He said,
there's funny little incidents like that, you know, but I noticed that the fellows would, say some homework, some fellows would have lead sinkers, they'd be melting them.
Melting lead sinkers? What were they doing that for? Or just to shape them up?
To make the sinkers. Okay.
So they could go fishing?
So they could go fishing.
Oh, that's nice. Not but, too often they could find a furnace they could do that with.
But that was before days of the union and before they had coffee breaks and all that stuff.
No coffee breaks in those days. What were the hours when you started? What was an 8-hour day?
8-hour day, yeah.
In the beginning, in 1930s?
Yeah, in 35, yeah. Then we went to 2 shifts and as the production increased, we went up to 3 shifts.
That's a full 24 hours.
24 hours, yeah. 6 days a week.
Was it 6 days a week when you started? You remember?
I don't think it was. I don't think it was.
But when you got up to the war, you moved into this
one. Yeah. But the best day I had that I could remember in our production, we had a schedule of 5,000 guns a day. 5,000 pieces, you know. And one day, over 24 hours, I made a record of getting out 7,000 pieces.
How did you do that?
Extra effort. We just made it a point to get them out. I didn't get any darn credit for it, I'll tell you that.
You didn't get any credit for it? How did you get the people to do that much extra work for you?
Oh, just
talking to them?
Just talking.
Encouraging them?
Encouraging them, yeah. Then after that period, I also was given charge of the metal finish, which was the department after our state. My throat is getting dry again. I swear, I have one of those lozenges.
What was the armory like to work for when you began? Did they have groups that got together after work? Did you go to a local bar or anything like that? Or?
No, not for the first... No, not for some time. No, I don't think we mixed too well at that time. But as the years go, went along. I wasn't a fellow that used to go to. Not that I don't go to bars, but I just wanted to come home.
After work.
Did they have any sports leagues or clubs or anything that...
Yeah. Well...
Bowling?
Oh yes, I was with the bowling team. And coming from Canada, I used to play hockey.
Ice hockey?
Yeah. And I organized a team there one year. We didn't have too much luck. It was a little fun, you know, so.
Where did you play hockey?
I played in the Boston Arena.
In the Boston
Arena? Here at the Armory? What?
Oh, no, no, we, no.
Then when you're down here at the Armory, where did you play?
I didn't play at the Armory. Where I was coaching it.
Mm-hmm.
And I played in the Coliseum.
In the Coliseum?
Mm-hmm. That I didn't have the Civic Center then, but so after I took over the metal finish, this is the in my final few years at the Armory, I took over the metal finish, file and polish, and investment casting, besides the heat treating. That's
a lot of departments.
Yeah. I had those four when I retired in 65.
Just a minute.
A short time ago. It's funny, he used to work in the next department to mine, the file and polish. He was assistant foreman there at one time.
What's his name?
George LaChapelle.
LaChapelle.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think she...
I
thought she was coming to pay back the dollar she owed.
Chances on things, and she didn't have any money.
For her,
you know. So I said,
"Sure,
we're still
eating."
Those things do happen, don't they?
Yeah. Hmm? No.
You were saying that you had gotten up working four departments.
That's right.
Where was your office? Did you have work from an office at that point?
Well, I still had the heat treat office. No, I was still in the heat treat office.
Did you have an assistant?
Yes, I had an assistant when I retired. Robert McDonald, he lives on Arden Street in Springfield. We keep in touch with each other, hear from each other now and then.
Did he work with you supervising the four departments, or did he specialize in...
Oh, he worked with the four departments,
the
yeah. Mm-hmm. But he spent a lot of time down at the water shops. He was assistant foreman down there for 15 years, and my assistant foreman died, I guess, and I got this fellow up in my place, a very good man.
How did you travel to work?
My own car.
Where did they have parking lots?
Oh yes, yeah. The parking lots are around the buildings there. Good park right beside the building. Yeah.
Were they assigned spaces, or did you just take whatever there was there?
We took whatever places were there. Naturally, the foreman could pick out his own spots. Look there now. never get, forget going up Whiting Hill there, snow thing. It was terrible, but I don't think I could have been late more than 4 or 5 times and all that. Thing.
What time are you supposed to be at work?
7 o'clock. 7 o'clock, huh?
And how long was lunch hour?
Half an hour.
This was toward the end of when you were working there?
All the time I was there.
Did you take your lunch with you, or?
No. No, when I first got married, I used to have my breakfast here, and then I thought, oh, geez, give her a break, I'd stop over in Springfield, and stop at a place along Columbus Avenue there. And then when they put up the cafeteria, start having breakfast over there. No, I very sick.
Across over on State Street, yeah. There was a restaurant there, wasn't there?
Oh, yes, yeah. I forget now.
Did you eat lunch in the cafeteria?
Yeah, all about 50-50, I guess, sometimes we'd feel it would be nice to get away from the darn place, go across the street.
Did they have a drink?
Yeah. Not me, not me. Oh, some of the fellas had their liquid lunch every day. I didn't have too many fellas with a drinking problem. But I recall when I first went there, you know, when I was still under Oliver and Parsons, a tool herder. That was about the highest working job in the department. And they were prima donnas. Oh, they know everything. This fellow had a drinking problem. So he used to go over, he'd stay out for a time, and Oliver used to send someone over to try and get him back on the job. So when Oliver turned over the job to me, Parsons was my baby. I started going over to him 3 or 4 times, you know, he'd be out on a tear. On one occasion I was over and he was lying down on the couch and says, "Ernie, this drinking is a bad habit." I say, "Understand? I don't have anything. I don't have any objections to drink. I think I drink myself. I'm not a preacher." "My God, Mac," he says, "I think you would make a good preacher." So he deflated me right there. But his wife would call up now and then, "Ernie's sick today." The fellow said, "I don't know if this is how she cured him." She used to cut off one of his pant legs.
Went to work like that?
Oh, he couldn't go to work. Oh, but boy, he was a terror.
But he was good at his job.
He was pretty good, you know. As I say, they thought they were prima donnas and wonderful. Even after Parsons had gone, he took his place very well. I guess he wanted more money, and he was talking about it. And stayed out. It was very unusual for him to stay out, and had stayed out a week. And I had broke another fellow in on the job, take it over. So in the week's time, Toomey called up, he says, "I don't think I can go to work yet." He said, "Don't bother about it." He says, "Leave the work until I come in." He says, "Okay." When he came in, I had fellow clean up all the work and get rid of it. That deflated that fella. You have to use a little psychology on.
Wasn't so indispensable, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. No man is indispensable. Now look, this is all about me. I'm giving you a story of my life.
Well, that's what we're looking for. That's what we want, the story of what it was like to work at the Army and your impressions.
I enjoyed it, and I felt conscientious about the work in this way. I thought, see, a lot of poor guys' life depends on these guns. And they should be careful about making them, you know, in case something malfunctioned and the fellow's life was at stake. That's what used to bother me. Another thing, they used to preach good attendance. So we did. We'd get after fellas that were out, you know, and we had a lot of trouble.
You'd get after them? How do you mean?
To take so much sick leave, you know, they had too much there. So I watched him so carefully, I forgot about my own. I had about 2,000 hours sick leave.
Did you never take it?
Never got paid.
Some fellas got paid. They changed the law a few years ago. They paid them for that, but...
$2,000.
Can you imagine if he got
that? Oh,
my, that would have made a nice sum to give to something, wouldn't it?
Lots of days he didn't feel that great, but he went to work. He just felt he should, you know. But everyone didn't.
I wouldn't say that I'm over conscientious, but.
But now you think of it, the money that.
Yeah, but when you know, just to get go and see some of the superintendents and big shots in the laboratory, which is next door to us, they didn't believe, or no one apparently believed in saving their sick leave. They'd use it as it accumulates. We used to get the 15 days a year. Well, they'd use 15, start the next 15.
And you never used it?
Not much,
no. I never stayed out any extended time. We had a fire in the department one night. The shifts were changing at 11 o'clock, and I got a call. Naturally, I went over and the fire started on the second floor. It was a locker room. The building was so small, it was made this way. The men and women's room was upstairs. Fellow and girl could go up the stairs together. He could go the right, he could go to the left. But I never heard of any hanky-panky going on. Probably there was some, but it didn't bother me. I never heard of any. But the space was so small, they had to use the upstairs.
And that's where the fire started?
The fire started up there.
Cigarettes?
I suspect it was a fella smoking, had a pipe, and he put the lighted pipe in his pocket or so, but we never proved it anyway. But we only lost one day's production. Mm-hmm.
Who discovered the fire? Do you know?
Well, I don't know, but... Oh, it must have been one of the fellows.
They didn't have smoke detectors.
Oh, no.
Had somebody used a fire? Did you have fire extinguishers around, or what did they do?
Well, we had fire extinguishers. This was in the new building. I'll never forget about these fire extinguishers. They installed fire extinguishers all around, but there was great chances of fire because the hot steel was put into the oil and it would flame up. You know. So they installed fire extinguishers all around the place, and shortly after it was done, one day the officers came down and Major Sepp, coming around with Macintosh was the superintendent. So what these fire extinguishers? I said, they were lately installed. Do they work?
I says, I supposed to do? He says, I'll find out. He went and pulled the switch. In jig time, all the apparatus. That set phone, so he was the devil.
So he called out the fire department.
He called out the fire department.
Did the army have its own fire brigade, or did they come from the city?
It came from the city. Oh, at first they had a... Oh, they had the firemen around there, so-called firemen. I guess until they got real big, the city departments come up. But in all that time, and we had another smaller fire, but it's remarkable, I think, after all those years, there was a few fires there, only two fires there.
You say the one you were speaking of was bigger. How much was involved? How many rooms or what?
It's most of the heat treating department. It was concerned with the, more or less with the roof, putting water up on the roof. The water got into the oil, and that would raise the devil.
That wouldn't work too well.
That didn't work too well. Not only that, the oil wouldn't be fit for further use.
Was the oil recycled, or how does a heat treatment work? Can you tell me sort of briefly? I realize it must be involved, but a little bit of it.
You know what a continuous belt is?
Yes.
Well, this was the latest refinement. You'd put the work on the belt, and it would go to the furnace, go in to the center part, which was all hot all around, heat work all around, go over until it reached the proper heat, and then it would drop off into oil. That was one kind of work. Some work, the work would go all the way through. That was for copper brazing.
Mm-hmm.
So we had three of those furnaces. We had two in our building, which is 106,
mm-hmm.
and one over in 103 on the other side of the street. We did the one over there. We did a wonderful job with that copper bracing.
The copper bracing, though, what part would that be in a gun?
Well, small parts of the gun, can I show you something? Something like this would be made first, something around like that.
Mm-hmm.
First they used to make them, cut the pieces out of a big steel like that. Then they got the idea of having tubes, and they could make so many more and save a lot of steel, you know. For the first steel, that would fall, be no good. And they could copper brace these together, you know, put them together like that. Put them through the furnace, 2,050 degrees.
2,050?
Yeah. That wasn't bad. That we had some furnaces that went up to, 2,200 degrees.
Now, what was the temperature in the room where you were working with these furnaces? The furnaces were that hot. How was the rest of the room?
Darn hot.
About how hot would you estimate?
The hottest. They never had any air conditioning there. Of course, they couldn't. Oh, I don't know. Jeepers, it must have been. Got up to 80, 90 there. Of course, the nearer you were to the heater. The furnaces, of course, they were all insulated. You know, there was brick between mm-hmm. the heat and the outside, but that didn't keep the heat in.
How did they fire the furnaces? Was this coal or?
No, electricity, mostly electricity. Just like a toaster.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I mean, the same idea. You put the thing in and the outside would get hot. When it was reached a certain temperature where you were sure the steel was hot all the way through, drop it into oil and it would be hard.
Now, how did you get it out of the oil?
Well,
was it still on this continuous belt, or
it dropped into the oil, and there was a continuous belt in the oil tank
to pick it up.
To pick it up.
So it sort of dropped through the oil, hit the other belt, and go out.
Someone touched it before it was on the floor. Then all that oil would have to be washed off. And we had tanks we do them in.
What did you use to wash the oil off?
Oh, mostly hot water. Hot water.
Then did these parts go through an inspection after they'd been through this process?
They sure did.
Were the inspectors in the same building there, or how did they do that?
They were in the same building.
Did they inspect each piece?
No, they couldn't inspect each piece.
I was wondering.
No, they couldn't inspect each piece. They take a certain sample every now and then.
You say that you were in one building on one side and there was another building on the other side of the street. Now, your building was doing copper braces. What was the other building doing?
Well, they were doing machine parts, but these parts were they were gun parts, and what we copper braced there would fit into the parts they were making. Of course, they'd have to have some machining after copper bracing. They'd have to take the extra copper off and all this stuff.
Did they have a salvage operation for the copper they took off, or was this?
No. No.
I remember, it seems to me the copper was hard to get for a while. I suppose
copper,
because it was being used in the war production.
Copper was, but the copper they used, that we used in parts, you know, they were so darn fussy in the laboratory. They'd have to copy the copper. You'd have to have a certain amount of zinc and tin and this and that. And in my mind, it didn't make a darn bit of difference because there was no strain on the parts that were braced.
Oh.
But someone got in on that, making those specifications. And they were buying the copper to all those specifications.
Now, who made the specifications? Is this an engineer at the armory, or what?
Or in the laboratory.
In the laboratory.
And I got the idea once. I ran out of copper for a certain side. I went over to the Nonatuck. What's the name of that Nonatuck place on the other side of the river? Got some copper anyway, and used it. Oh, I know the difference. I was sure in my own mind
it would work.
Sure.
Sounds perfectly reasonable.
Well, I tried to cut corners when I could, because when you find out the function of the parts, you know, what they had to do was you could give it the best idea what they should make. And we got along, I got along real well with Mr. Garand. He was there when I started. He retired before I did. He was a smart cookie, but he knew quite a bit. He thought he knew quite a bit about the heat treated, you know. He'd send something over, or he'd come over with it himself, and he'd say, "Well, I want this heated to 1600 degrees." He says, "Okay. I think you could save some time and money by heating it to 1550. I said 1600 degrees. So we used to stick to it, you know. Then after the last few years, I found he mellowed quite a bit, you know. He'd call up with something over. "How do you want this heat treated, Mr. Webb? Use your own judgment." he mellowed quite a bit. He was quite a guy.
Found he could trust you then, he'd...
I guess he found out he could trust me. I don't think he had too much effect, but... You know, the fellows, his assistants would come over with something, and they'd say, John wants this heated, and so and so. And I said, look, that isn't right. And they call him, oh, I wouldn't if I were you, mate. They were scared of him. Gee, I should be telling all this.
Oh, it's very good. It's very interesting. Actually, I'm going to have to leave before too long. I will probably come back again, if I may. I have another appointment I'm going to have to make. I'd like to come back another day, if I may.
Oh, sure. Now, what other people did you interview?
Well, they say we're just beginning. We've got about 100 and...
Oh, my goodness.
130 responses. About 20 women have answered.
Yeah.
Who will be able to talk to them. Some are going to be in other states, and how we'll work that on you. You retired before the armory closed.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Did they hold a retirement dinner? Did they do that kind of thing?
Never a thing.
Why don't you get something for once? You got something.
For what? Oh, I got a 30-year, a 30-year
period.
Every month, but that was 30 years.
That wasn't any dinner, you know.
No.
Were you a you mentioned the union. Would you have been a member of the union, or was that?
That started in the last few years, you know.
Were you a member?
I guess I was, yeah.
But it wouldn't have been too important at your level, I guess.
No.
But some of the men who worked for you would have been.
Oh, yes. They had a hard time getting the unions in, getting the union in. Yeah.
They had a hard time?
Yeah.
People didn't want a union?
No, they didn't want a union.
What kind of a union was it when they came in? Did different unions try to come in, or was it just...
I don't know how they arranged that, but... There was another thing there, you know, there were different cliques, of course, as there are in any place like that. There was what they used to call them, the Spurns. I'm mentioning this to you. Not anything derogatory about it, but a funny incident about it, you know. The Springfield Armory Masonic Society. Yeah, Spurns. And they got pretty strong there. And, of course, they tried to get there, do what they could there.
End of interview for today.